Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is the Golf Under Par podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jeremy McCullough. We are on a journey to find the information that's going to help you play the best golf of your life. Join us now as we dive in. Welcome to the Golf Under Par podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jeremy McCullough, here with special guest Mitch Sadowski. Mitch is a director of golf fitness at Lake Nona Golf and Country Club in Orlando, Florida. He also does some strength coach at Coastal Performance, and he's got his own thing going, Mitch 11 Strength and Performance. So you guys can check him out at some of those places. We'll get his links and stuff like that later in the show, but let's get ahead and get welcome Mitch to the show. And thank you for being here, Mitch.
Jeremy, thanks for having me. What are the listeners called? Are they called Guppers? Guppies?
I've kind of played with the idea. I don't know what sounds the best. Neither one has a great
no, it doesn't. We got to come up with something though.
Yeah. Like you said, there's a couple episodes where I would say, "Hey, welcome Guppers or Guppies and Gupsters," and I'm like, "Oh, I don't know what's a good one." So
yeah, we'll see if we can come up with something, or have people send in their best suggestions.
That sounds like a good idea. We'll have it. Yeah. So you can shoot an email at me and. You know, golfunderpar@gmail.com, and we'll see what you guys think. But so thank you for coming on here. What got you into golf?
I don't know. I guess it's to take a page out of some kids' books. I guess there are a series of fortunate events. I kind of golfed a little bit as a kid. I was just an active kid in the Midwest. We did pretty much every sport, and golf was included. It never had a lesson, just, you know, and like just enjoyed crushing the ball, seeing how far I could hit it. And hopefully it went straight rather than hard right, hard left. You know, along with that, it sort of became a hobby. And when I was in grad school, I had a lot of free time. I had a master's in sport management at Ball State University. And they were duplicates of a lot of my regular classes because I made it in sport administration. And I was bored. I was helping coach the men's volleyball team in grad school and still just had a lot of free time. So a couple of our athletic trainers and I would go grab our sticks and hack around some of the Delaware County golf courses and just really enjoyed it. And after I left the world of college volleyball coaching, I moved to Orlando. Part of the reason why I got into strength training was as a college volleyball coach, I was really frustrated with the physicality, but the physical preparedness of what were supposed to be collegiate athletes. So I just decided to put my money where my mouth is. If you're going to complain about something, might as well be part of the solution. So I started strength training, and that's where I guess these series of fortunate events happened. Cause one of the girls that I was coaching in high school, her dad owned a gym, and I asked him about picking up some training hours, and he said, "Yeah, sure, go right ahead." And so I started hanging out at his gym and picked up a couple people. And a few months later, he said he was moving to the Bahamas to open up the fitness center at Albany, which is one of the Tavistock properties. And not long after that, he called me and said, "Hey, if you're interested, Lake Nona is going to be hiring a strength coach. They've got one name and one resume, and the job's yours if you want it." And at that time, I was kind of in between coaching jobs a little bit. So I decided, you know, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it. And so I pulled my resume from some coaching applications and dove head first and the world of strength training and golf. And obviously being at Lake Nona, we're around some of the best golfers in the world. And so I picked up a few established pros, some aspiring professionals and high level amateurs. And I think the saying is the rest they say is history. And just kept going from there.
Yeah, definitely seems like a series of fortunate events there.
Yeah. Yeah. But, so, I think it's more than kind of falling backwards into things. It's just seeing where opportunity is. Prior to that, I'd been fired from, I think, 4 different jobs. Hockey team that I worked for, downsized, and I was part of the layoffs. Staff got fired at one coaching job, staff got fired at another coaching job. And I was like, you know what? I'm kind of tired of having my career and my job in other people's hands. So if anyone's going to fire me for whatever reason, I think I'm going to be the one calling the shots here, where, success is directly, or success or failure is directly in my hands. So, it's been a good transition, and I mean, I can't say that there's a bad aspect to my job. I love what I do.
Yeah. It shows you fickleness of, some of those coaching jobs, right? Like,
yeah,
not only you, college. It's the whole staff. It's
yeah. And it's, college coaching stuff. I mean, everyone sees the perks and cool. I mean, it is, it's awesome, but there is, like, you can have a couple of the athletes that don't like the team rules, or, for some reason they just can't not drink for 24 hours before a match, or, anything that yeah, they don't like about the coach or the program. And all of a sudden, they're readily looking to move on from that staff. And, not to say it's bad. I have phenomenal relationships still, 15, 16 years later with a lot of the college athletes that I coached. But I just wanted to have a little bit more say in what my day-to-day life was like. And, it's a pretty cool thing to have that type of autonomy and freedom, but also have a lot of structure to the day as well. And plus, I don't know if I want to sleep in my office, our guest bed's right behind me. I don't have to worry about sleeping on the floor in between matches with Wake Forest and Duke.
right. That's fun. At least some good memories there, right? With
all. Oh yeah, absolutely.
But that's cool. So you said about 15, 16 years, more doing the fitness.
Yeah.
Fitness training and whatnot. And you've worked with volleyball, you've worked with hockey, it sounds like, and obviously golfers, with your roles that you're currently in. So
yeah,
I've seen your social media and some of your posts there. You're talking recently about some tight muscles. Right. And so golfers are always talking about mobility and needing to stretch this or that. And so I wanted to get your kind of opinion, your process of figuring out, does somebody need to stretch, or, is there a time where they actually need to strengthen it?
Yeah, I think everything starts at the beginning, which for me is a movement screen. I prefer TPI, and then I also have some elements of FMS and SFMA in there, and then just a little bit of a breathing assessment picked up from Dr. Belisa Vranek in her book Breathing for Warriors. So I'll take them through that assessment. For a lot of our higher level athletes, we'll add in the power portion. So for people that are familiar with TPI level 2, the power testing, we'll do that. And then add in the Y balance and functional capacity screen from FMS, which will kind of give me an idea of how somebody's moving, whether they're overpowered, underpowered. And we'll start to see where some patterns develop. And then for a lot of my athletes, we'll do all of those getting into their off season, just to see where they are. We'll do a shorter version of those every couple months just to kind of see where they are. But everything starts with an assessment, and then we start to see some patterns develop per athlete. And then we start to kind of have an idea of where golfers tend to fit. So a lot of them tend to have a stronger but less stable trail leg, and a, I don't want to say weaker, but there's less power output and a little bit more stable lead leg, just because of the nature of their sport. They're always shifting weight onto the lead leg, rotating over it. So they just, they tend to develop some stronger breaks on the lead side. The breaks aren't as strong just because they're not necessary on the trail side. So we start to look at that, see what other, funky patterns emerge. We'll kind of see what some swing faults are. We'll see what some habits golfers tend to fall back into from compensatory patterns. And then we just kind of go to work from there. We'll see what their goals are. And then we can take what we see in the screen with what their goals are and mesh those two things together. So the athlete gets what they want. We're just going to keep them working out. And then what they need, which is where they're going to see a lot of the success that they and the progress that they want.
Yeah. And so you mentioned you can kind of get the differences side to side because of the lead and the trail legs and whatnot there. And so what are other kind of things you found? We'll focus on the, amateur golfer with, most of the listeners are either kind of the lower single digits to, you got a handful that are working on improving their score, getting into those 80s and whatnot. So it's kind of,
yeah, I think, Jeremy, that's pretty good. Cause I mean, you can take an 18 handicapper down to a 10 really quickly. It's a lot harder to go from a 4 to a 3 or a 3 to a 1 or a 1 to a scratch. So you're kind of looking at those tiny little 1% wins. And that for me is generally breathing patterns and feet. I'm a real big proponent of both breathing and what foot mechanics are doing. The better the foot mechanics, the better somebody's hip mobility is going to be. And same thing with breathing. Someone with good breathing patterns is going to have a little bit more movement through their upper body and the thoracic area of their spine, or at least just the thoracic area in general. People who are poor breathers tend to have poor scapular mobility, just because what the shoulder blades are doing with the rib cage in terms of inhalation and exhalation. If you want to get a little bit deeper into breathing, you can also see where stress breathers are. They're very, very top of the chest. They're really tight in their traps. Scaps don't really like to move. So you see a lot of people with that hunched shoulder pattern, kind of that shrug into their takeaway and shrug through their follow through, which is going to be a pretty limiting movement pattern. So getting them to breathe, control their breath work a little bit better. And then that can control some gait patterns, pelvic position, how the diaphragm and pelvic floor are integrating together. And then obviously what the feet are doing, because most people spend entirely too much time in their shoes. Yeah. So I mean, the one thing that I try to do with my professional golfers is, whenever you come into our gym, you'll see a good portion of our athletes out of their shoes. Even if it's just in their socks, just getting them out of their shoes, getting their toes to spread, getting their feet to interact with the ground a little bit more. I can't remember who said this, but walking around with shoes and socks all day is like wearing really thick mittens, really dark glasses, and noise canceling headphones and trying to operate yourself throughout the day. Like there's just, it's a sensory deprivation system for your feet, and it just takes away a lot of the interaction that your feet, nerves in your feet, the fascia and the brain, it just takes away a lot of that proprioception. So we try to get that back to them.
Yeah, I love that 100% because I oftentimes will get people, you know, just like waking up their feet just by like rolling something underneath the ball, the arch of their foot. That way, you know, they get that sensory back in there because, like you said, it dampening all that sensation that's coming in through there. So,
yeah.
What particularly are you looking at with golfers in their mechanics? Are we looking at, you know, kind of like inversion, eversion or how that rock, or are we looking at, you know, toe mobility? What kind of thing is it?
Well, the first thing I'm going to look at are what their toes are doing. Can their toes splay? Can they move them like you're typing on a keyboard? Can they xylophone their toes? And you know, mostly do they have big toe control? So again, big toes, the thumb are similar to it. And if that big toe, you'll see a lot of people whose big toe kind of gets glued into the second toe and it doesn't really move. You'll generally tend to see some people with poor hip mobility on that side. Some of them may have a little bit of low back pain, low back stiffness, just because that hip doesn't move. So we try to get those toes moving a little bit better, a little bit better foot control. And then, you know, from the medical side of things, if we can get people to get their big toes or their feet adjusted, all of a sudden, like a lot of people who kind of see like that tension in their low back clears up right away. And it's, you know, they think it's magic, but we just kind of understand how the chain of things works.
Yeah. As a physical therapist and having people do, after a surgery, you know, whether it's, you know, bone spurs or something on those lines, you know, whatever it may be, talking to them about the importance of that big toe. And they always look at me like, it seems kind of odd that you're talking to me about the big toe and its importance. And it's like, oh yeah, but how much easier it makes walking and whatnot and the strain that it can take off of, like you were just saying, the back even, or the hip and those kind of things. And it's very interesting. Some of those connections and the number of times I bring up that song that your mom taught you as a kid, the shin bones connected to the thigh bone. That is true.
It is. Yeah. And plus, if you look at golf footwear, golf shoes tend to have a very narrow or short toe box.
Yeah.
So just by nature of the shoe, like toes do not come to that arrow point, you know, they splay out. So why we have shoes with such a long toe and narrow toe box and what that's going to do to your feet. Like, if you ever take off a pair of shoes, you're like, oh man, that feels so much better. You're in the wrong shoe. Yeah. Like, I don't care how good it looks. You're in the wrong shoe. You know, your toes should have room to move. And you know, I think we all go back to getting fit for kids or getting fit for shoes as kids. And you know, your foot's on the Brannock device and they're sliding the thing up to the big toe and where it is. And, you know, they're putting the thumb on, we'll get your toes and see where it is. And, you know, toes are jammed right up to the front. You know, we want to make sure that we have enough room to move, because just like anything else, like you put something in a position long enough, it's just gonna stop moving the way that we would like. So, you know, that's one of the things we want to attack first. And then obviously with that is the breathing.
Yeah, yeah. So let's tackle it. So I got a couple questions there. One about breathing, one about the shoes, but let's go with the breathing. Yeah. Since you just brought it up. What do you kind of do when you're assessing somebody? What's something that maybe the listeners could kind of see how they're breathing, or, you know, make some changes.
I think a really simple one that you can do on your own is just lay on your back, feet flat, knees in the air. Kind of like if you were to start in a glute bridge or a hip thrust position. And then, just breathe normally. And you'll start to kind of see where you breathe. You know, the lower back's going to kind of peel off the ground a little bit. You're going to feel a lot of that upper chest, upper pectoral breathing. And you're going to kind of see your shoulders rise on the ground. So they're going to go up towards your ears and you'll start to feel that. So then you can kind of use some of the things around you to cue into better breathing. So put your hands on the bottom of your rib cage, exhale, make sure your rib cage is kind of, you can feel that expansion in the lower part of the rib cage. You can start to feel your diaphragm. For a lot of people who breathe inefficiently, if you get them to breathe into their back enough, you're going to feel, they'll feel some spasm in their back, and you're trying to cue that, 'cause that's actually their diaphragm getting some work back there. And it's, you know, kind of really tight, 'cause it hasn't been used properly. you're like, oh man, it's really cramping back there. I'm like, well, good. We need it to. And then all of a sudden it starts to relax a little bit. And then you can start to feel the diaphragm really start to pull down and allow the lungs to inflate and start to feel the rib cage move a little bit better. A lot of people, when they get off the floor, feel a little bit lightheaded because they haven't been taking that much oxygen in before, but they tend to feel a lot better. And then you can start to cue some things from there, you know, push your back into the floor as you breathe, you know, feel your rib cage go out, because most people want their rib, feel their rib cage move just vertically, almost up towards their chin. And we'd like to have the sternum kind of act as a pump handle. So it goes up away from you to the ceiling to allow the ribs to expand and then push back down for the exhalation.
Yeah.
So like that way, I mean, the ground from a developmental perspective provides a good sensory rich environment. There's a ton of interaction with the floor that your body is now starting to feel a little bit. The brain's starting to interact. I can feel where I need to breathe into now. And then, you know, you can use that as your practice, and then to progress from there, we'll turn them over into a quadruped position, hands and knees, and then start to get them to, give them some tactile cues on their back, tap their ribs, tap their back, make sure that they're starting to expand through there, and just kind of work from that position.
And so do you incorporate much of that kind of breathing into some of your mobility work or anything along those lines?
Yeah. So the funny thing is, Jeremy, if you work on your breathing, you really don't have to do much mobility work. Essentially what you're doing is you expand the breathing, you're going to expand fascia throughout the body, because now we're getting more and more oxygen in through the cells. We're really expanding our range of motion. So as we've heard, I'm not sure any of our listeners, but proximal stability equals distal mobility. So the more stability we can provide closer to the spine, the more mobility we're going to have away from the spine. And that just starts with breathing. Filling the canister, and the canister is from the diaphragm through to the pelvic floor. So the more control we have over that area, the better we're going to move. So you can clean up a lot of mobility issues just by cleaning up breathing. And then we can really understand, you know, from my perspective as a strength professional, if I find that we've attacked breathing and cleared some of that up and we still have some mobility issues, we kind of feel a hard endpoint when we're going through some passive stretching or some joint movement. If there's a hard endpoint, I just refer them. I call my DPT or I call our chiro and anyone who can do hands-on, and I'll say, hey, this is what we have. This is what I found. And I'm going to refer them out to you because this is now out of my lane. So I don't mess around with that too much. I think the team approach for some of our upper level golfers is important. And then if there's obviously anything more concerning outside of that, you know, we refer out pretty much right away. And we're fortunate to have a really good network and a really good team that we work with.
Good. So it sounds like you kind of start most of your training with that breathing to kind of get the, we'll say, reset for the body even, or the reset for the kind of the,
yeah,
the joints and muscles, yeah, and whatnot. And then get into some of that warm up dynamic.
Yeah. Warm-up. A lot of times, especially because, you know, for us, it's just systems. I think if you're training, or look, even if you're an amateur golfer, if you don't have a system for your game, then you're pretty much just trying to throw rocks in the desert and hoping you hit water. You're probably not going to, it's not going to work, because how do you know what to warm up? Like, how do you know what patterns you've developed? How do you know where your deficiencies are? You don't need a full hour corrective warm-up before you go hit balls. But on the other side, you don't want to roll up to the first tee, light your cigar, crack open the can of beer, and let it rip. For us, everything does start with breathing, just because how many people start with breathing on their own? Like, how many people have a really good, healthy breathing pattern all day long? Very few. So We'll start with breathing. That way I know everything's in the space and in the spot that it should be. Everything should be moving as well as it should. That way we can start to go in through some of our dynamic movements, our corrective exercise, because again, a corrective exercise without addressing breathing, you're just going to chase your tail around, because most of the time that mobility restriction is caused by poor breathing. So we'll take care of that first, because that's where we start our correctives. That's where we're going to start our warm up, and it doesn't take long. So we'll go breathing, we'll go any type of corrective movement, we'll go to a dynamic warm up, and then we pretty much use just kind of like a Mike Boyle approach of explosive exercise first, strength exercise second, any motor skill acquisition we'll do towards the front of the workout, and then we'll do our accessory exercises at the end.
Yeah, that's nice little outline for anybody that's interested in you know, kind of following that same thing to can improve your performance there. So I wanted to get back into you, we're talking about toes and shoes and whatnot. What is your, I guess your take on, you mentioned how, you know, a lot of the shoes are very narrow, particularly golf shoes are narrow and whatnot. So are you recommending maybe even like wearing more of those tennis shoes or the wide, you know, something on those lines instead, or just finding one of those brands? Cause I know there's a few out there that have been, you know, pushing that more, we'll say.
Yeah, I think if you were to line up 10 people, I could probably find you 10 differently shaped feet, sometimes 20. but yeah, I think for me, it's finding something that fits and is comfortable. I actually don't wear golf shoes when I golf. I've got a couple of really comfortable pairs of trainers, and that gives me all the grip I need. And you know what, like, depending on where you are, like if you're hitting off a mat, you don't really need spikes.
No.
And you know, a lot of the other, some of the muni courses probably hacked up. So you're going to have a hard time gripping on some of the 4-inch holes that people have dug. Yeah. And then if you're in a really nice course, fairways probably, or the tee box probably pretty well manicured. So, yeah, I just kind of like to make sure people wear something comfortable that fits and that works for their feet. So that's kind of my suggestion. I haven't, with the number of golf shoes out there now, I haven't really taken too much a look at what all is out there. My suggestion is, you know, especially to try to get people to walk more when they golf, wear something comfortable.
Yep. Yeah. I also wear just my tennis shoes basically. That I have, and again, give more feeling to my feet. The only time I wish I had, you know, more golf shoes is when I have to get into some slushiness, you know. Yeah. When I get a little too close to the water or it's been raining. So
yeah,
awesome. So then with the toes, so I wanted to talk a little about the use of toes during training sessions, you know, whether that's like the squats or lunges and those kinds of things. What are some of your cues? You know, you're doing that work to get the isolation of that big toe you're talking about. And so how do you use that with training?
So I'm trying to get people to understand what toes are for. Like, toes are for gripping the ground, but I tried to, the analogy of the external cue that I use is to look over the cliff, but don't white knuckle it. So we want to be close enough to the edge where we can kind of take a look over and, you know, look at the Grand Canyon. Well, let's not be white knuckling the rim. That kind of gets them to kind of get that feel of still being in their heels, a little bit of balance. A great drill that I actually picked up from Don Stanley at the PGA show a couple of years ago is standing on an alignment stick so that it runs under the midfoot of both feet, and do side to side rocks, do front to back rocks. And that'll kind of help you find your center, and you'll understand if you're too far forward, too far back, if you've got too much pressure on one side or the other. That's a really good drill that I like to kind of get people to understand where they're supposed to be. And then, I think, training barefoot for the right exercises are great. I do not train in shoes unless I'm riding the assault bike, because those spikes will tear up my foot from the pedal. But yeah, I train barefoot almost exclusively. I really do not like shoes. I've got some that are pretty comfortable, but most of the time I'm barefoot. I'm barefoot right now. So that's kind of what I try to get people to do, is just to feel their feet a little bit more. Is just to, we'll squat barefoot, deadlift, kettlebell swings, Olympic lifts, we'll wear shoes. A lot of other things we'll wear shoes, but I've had athletes who, if we do any bounding work or lateral work or even that, they want to go outside and run on the grass and go barefoot. So we'll do our skips, we'll do our speed work barefoot in the grass. Yep. We'll do a lot of the high knees, skipping, they'll do the bounding, they'll do all that barefoot.
Yeah, yeah. It provides all that sensory, right, when you're doing that stuff. So
yeah. Yeah, so, absolutely.
It's good. Oftentimes my recommendation for those that have like neuropathy and whatnot, just physical therapy, they're finding that something as simple as just showing them, hey, this is a smooth surface, this is a rough surface, and then having them feel that with their feet has improved some of that. Maybe it doesn't give them more sensation, but it improves their sensation that they do have, and it decreases some of that numbness, tingly feel that they get. It's a kind of an interesting thing. And so like I started recommending people, hey, just go walk on different surfaces. You got hardwood floors, you got rugs, you got, concrete outside, maybe some sand, like just get some different surfaces to get the foot feeling a little something different than the inside of a shoe or sock every single day, all day. So.
Fortunately, being in Florida, we get beach access year round. So, we haven't as much with our, we've got a 9-month-old daughter, but before she was born and probably before my wife's, I would say probably 6th month of pregnancy, we'd walk down to the Deerfield Beach, or we'd drive down to the Deerfield Beach pier and walk down to the Boca Jetty and back. And it's about a 3.5-mile walk. We do that at sunrise, and we feel great doing that. When things got shut down during the pandemic, we'd go for walks in the afternoon, as it was cooling down a little bit, and we would even walk, we'd walk 4 miles, cement, grass, street, whatever, barefoot. Just developed some pretty terrible looking, but strong feet.
All right. So we want to talk about some speed and distance. That's everybody's favorite topic these days. And I've seen you doing a couple different posts here talking about, breaks. And so I wanted to get on and establishing those breaks. You kind of alluded to that a little bit earlier with some of the assessment talking that you were talking about with the lead hip and whatnot. So, what are the breaks? Why are they important? Those kinds of things. And then I'm really curious as to, with your training, where do you kind of focus that
at? Yeah. When they say that people are afraid of heights, they're really not afraid of heights. They're afraid of falling. When you're afraid of falling, you're not afraid of falling. You're afraid of the rapid and immediate deceleration. So I think when we talk about deceleration, it's how good are you at landing? How good are you at slowing down? When you see sprinters sprint, like, do they come to a complete stop or do they slow down? They eventually slow down because they're going so fast. Well, right. How quickly can you slow down, and how much control do you have over that? And the better the control you have over that deceleration, the more your brain's going to say, okay, I'm comfortable moving at a faster speed because I'm comfortable with how quickly we can control our deceleration. If you can't decelerate, your body's just going to turn on a little bit of a governor, and it's not going to give you the range that you would like. It's like, I don't feel comfortable slowing down, so we're just going to slow you down. So you're at a more comfortable speed for us to operate at. So when you talk about deceleration, I love depth jumps. Step off a box, start low, learn how to land first, learn how to broad jump short distances. I mean, we're not talking about NFL combine, so you don't have to broad jump 12 feet. But if you can broad jump 4 feet and eventually work your way up to, I want to say it's TPI or the FCS. There's a correlation between your broad jump height and the your height. Yes. So if you can broad jump your height, you're going to do pretty well. But the most important part of the broad jump is the landing. So you don't want to fall back. You don't want to fall forward. You want to learn how to use the ground and decelerate, and then you can work on rotational broad jumps. How quickly can you accelerate and drive out of one side or the other? So I think that type of work is crucial. It doesn't have to be a full hour of it. I think, you know, for me, it's the minimal effective dose. If we get, I don't really have a magic number, but, you know, I think if we can get a few in per day of different things, the body starts to develop that type of competency, and then we'll give you a little bit more permission to get a little bit further and a little bit further and a little bit further. So, you know, we try to get some type of broad jump, bounding, deceleration work pretty much every training session with our athletes.
Okay. Very cool. Do you do anything that doesn't involve much jumping for some of the older adults, or do you think just starting small and that kind of gets them?
I think it depends on the adult, and it depends on what they're comfortable doing. Yeah. You know, we've got some that you kind of got to pull them back a little bit because they forget that they haven't, you know, they're not as young and spry as they used to. And
yeah.
they don't have the mobility that we would like to really start to jump high, but they think they want to jump high. So those are the ones that will probably depth jump more because we can lower that box down and just have them step up and jump off and teach them the deceleration pattern. And then, you know, I'm not a big fan of really, really high box jumps for any athlete at any age. It's not a great test of vertical. It's a really good test of rapid rate of hip flexion and see how well the lumbar can flex under load, which is fine. If that's what you're trying to attain, then high box jumps are really, really great for that. You also see somebody with really, you know, people with really good dorsiflexion. I like, you know, especially being a volleyball player, I like to see how high people can jump without having a knee tuck, just because you can't hit a volleyball up in the air with your knees tucked like that.
Right.
I think that type of work's always real important. And you just kind of layer on what the athlete's capable of. And I think if we take a long-term training approach, whether you're starting somebody at 6, 16, or 60, I think if you have a 20-year plan in mind of how you're going to develop that athlete, there's no way you can go wrong. If I'm training a 60-year-old and in 20 years, I want them to, deadlift 400 pounds. It's doable. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. Would I deadlift that 60-year-old at 400 if they can't deadlift 135? No. I wouldn't even deadlift a 60-year-old who can deadlift 350. I wouldn't deadlift them 400.
Yeah.
But, you know, they start where they start, and then we work forward towards our goal. Pavel Satsulin, the chairman of Strong First, his father-in-law was 77 and won I don't know if he won the powerlifting meet, but I know he deadlifted 400 pounds at 77 years old. So, you know, I think there's a lot that goes into what you're doing before that, but I also know that he hadn't been training, you know, his entire life for that. So they had to start somewhere.
Yeah.
So
There's always that starting.
It's completely doable. Do I do that with everybody? No, but you know, I can tell you, every single one of my athletes that I work with deadlifts. We don't deadlift 400, but everybody deadlifts.
Yep. Yeah, and you know, for the listeners, you know, some people listen and go, "Oh, deadlift, I can't do that," and whatnot. And I usually just say, "Do you ever bend down to get a yes. Tupperware out of the bottom drawer of your cupboards?" Like, yeah, well, you pretty
pick
much
a golf ball up out of the hole. Okay, right. You just deadlifted your golf ball.
Exactly. So you can start even as little as that, and that's your beginning stages of a deadlifting. So
right, and then it just becomes they've got to feel comfortable. They've got to take the stigma out of deadlift, because everyone has the idea of the mountain deadlifting 1,200 pounds. Like, that's not really where we're going to be going with this. You know, if we can get you to 50 pounds, like, that'll work. But I think most golfers who don't deadlift, I think they'll find that either a traditional deadlift or a trap bar deadlift or even a single leg deadlift, if they're not doing any of those at all, adding that into their training is probably going to have a pretty, pretty, pretty big effect. Patrick Dooley, who's another strength coach and instructor in Ireland, he did a study at his clubs, at his club, just getting, I think he took a group of 25 people. He just had them doing push-ups. That's it. Just push-ups. And then tested their swing speed before and after, and had a control group who just didn't do anything. Then had a group do push-ups. And funny enough, group that did push-ups, that's it. Just no other lifting. Just do push-ups. Every one of them picked up club head speed and distance off the tee. So, you know, sometimes it's, you know, there's no real big secret. It's just lift, get stronger. You get stronger, your brakes are going to be better. If the brakes are better, you're going to be able to hit the ball farther.
Yep. All right. So yeah, you stay active, get strong. And that's the secret. It's just a matter of how you want to get around to it, what your limitations are. Like you said at the beginning of the assessment, you got to know where to begin, where your issues, where are your weaknesses, your strengths, and then target as appropriate.
Well, yeah, I think too is have a plan. Like, you have to have an endpoint, work to the endpoint. Once you get to the endpoint, just reset, like reassess your goals, and then reset the goal where you're going to be. If your goal is to deadlift 400, that's great. That's awesome. It's a very worthy goal. Then how do we work to that? And that's the same thing. If you want a 300-yard drive, that's cool. Like, perfect. So now we have our endpoint. But do you want to hit that 300 drive once? You want to hit that 300-yard drive every time? Like, okay, fine. Like, now we have our endpoint. Let's just work towards that. And then, you know, obviously things have to be, you know, does somebody want a 400-yard drive? And someone's like, well, that's ridiculous. Well, Bryson came along and showed that's not ridiculous. You just have to train a certain way to do that.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, it's been a good discussion, Mitch. I got a few, you know, I call them the mulligan round, where you're allowed to skip one question. All right. So what's the worst club in your bag?
I will say my 5 hybrid.
All right. What's the best round you've ever had?
You know what? I got to go with the best friend I ever had. Oh, best round I ever had. I was going to say best friend. Best round ever. You know what? I have not kept score in probably about 10 years. What I do is I have a floating par system. So the last probably 10 years of rounds, I've birdied every hole I played. So sometimes it's a par 9 because I shot 8. Sometimes it's a par 10 because I shot 9. If I ever hit 10, I just pick the ball up and we call it a draw at par and we walk to the next hole. But I hit enough golf shots to continue to enjoy playing and get a little bit better. And before too long, I'm sure I'll reevaluate my scoring system, but it keeps me pretty happy right now.
Hey, that's the most important part. Have fun and enjoy it, right?
That's right.
Awesome.
Well, I measure myself to other golfers by height, since I'm 6'3".
Right. all right. So what would you choose as a superhero power?
Oh man. You know, I've been thinking about this. I would have to say, I don't want to read people's thoughts because I know there are some people who just don't like me, and I don't, you know, I already know that. I don't need to read their minds for that. I will say ability to fly.
All right. What's your go-to karaoke song?
The Humpty Dance by Digital Underground. I can rock that thing out. In fact, I could sing it right now if we want. I won't even need the background.
We'll be all right. Thank you, though. What's the weirdest golf term you think?
Albatross. We go from a birdie to an eagle. Eagles are pretty badass. Can we go to an albatross? We got to find a little, like, phoenix, something that's a little bit more fierce than an eagle. I think we made a big jump from birdie to eagle. I think from there, because it's not a double eagle. I think we got to come up with a more badass bird name than albatross.
I heard Max Homa calls it a super eagle, so he's pushing that.
We could do that
for that. So
yeah, I can get down with that.
All right, what's your favorite exercise or drill to improve your personal game or your, you know, personal?
If I could do one thing for the rest of my life, it would be kettlebell swings.
All right. What do you want everybody to take away from today?
Get assessed, set some goals, work towards those goals. And set a time limit on those goals. If you don't achieve those goals, reassess why you didn't get there and then go after those goals again. If you made those goals, evaluate how you got there, set some more goals, and then go after them.
There you go. Last question.
And move better, breathe better, and get out of your damn shoes.
Lots of takeaways. All right. Yeah. Last question. If you could have a professional hit your tee ball or your putt, which would you prefer? Doesn't any professional? Not, you don't have to choose a professional. Ooh. Just would you rather have the professional hit the tee ball or hit the putt?
I would say, I think most people would say driver. I'm going to go with the putt. Professionals are pretty good putters.
Yeah.
So let me hack it up to the green and then I'll let you sink my putt.
Sounds good. Just let John Rahm do that, 60 foot putt every time, drain that thing.
I got to go with my boy Poulter in the Ryder Cup. I'm just going to tell him it's a Ryder Cup. It's a Ryder Cup match and I need that putt.
Hey, did you hear? Today's a Ryder Cup. I can't believe it. It's amazing. And
yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Somebody I'm pretty sure has already tried that for him, right?
I'm sure somebody's tried. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on, man. Let us know how we can learn more about you.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Well, let me know how can we follow you and learn more about you.
Yeah. If you want a lot of golf information, I'm on Instagram at Mitch Sadowski. Just me complaining about Wisconsin sports teams or making smart aleck remarks. I'm on Twitter at the same handle, at Mitch Sadowski. Facebook is Mitch11Strength. And my website is mitch11strength.com.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We'll have that in the show notes. Everybody, thank you for listening.
Yeah.
The Gupsters, Guppies, Gups, whatever. We'll figure it out. Let us know. Thanks, Mitch. Have a good one, man.
Awesome. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you guys for listening to this episode. Hopefully you've enjoyed this content on the go. If you found it helpful, please share with a friend and leave us a review on iTunes. This allows us to reach more golfers, just like you, that want to play under par. Do you want to be stronger and healthier? Well, I've got a resource, Golf Fitness Tips. It's a free Facebook group where we talk about how to take care of our bodies so that we can play more golf, we can play golf longer in life, and we can play better on the course. If that interests you, then check out the link below or search for Golf Fitness Tips on Facebook.